Hello and welcome to the Total Football Soccer Show, Richmond's first, only, and therefore best soccer talk show. I'm Daryl.
And I'm Taylor.
And this week on the show,
we'll talk about the UEFA Champions League and why it may be the most inappropriately named tournament in football.
In honour of Emmanuel Adebayor's controversial 100-yard sprint, we'll list our top five most memorable goal celebrations.
Plus, we review last week's highly controversial spelling bee and move on to this week's theme, the letter H.
Or H.
H. So this week saw the return of the Champions League, which is a tournament for Europe's biggest and best clubs. The tournament's divided into 32 teams, 8 groups, with 4 teams in each group.
Yeah, and those 32 teams are selected. It basically should be, or the competition started as, the winners of each domestic league around Europe.
Right.
But as it's expanded and they wanted the more glamorous teams in there, it's also now second, third, fourth place teams from the more glamorous countries like England, Spain, Italy.
Right. And I feel like that's sort of the problem with it. You know, if it started off as just like the champions of every single country, it'd be a really interesting tournament.
And that's what we used to have. It was called the European Cup, and there were no group stages. There were just knockout games, and every team in there was the champion from the previous season. And it was fantastic, but it didn't earn as much money as the Champions League, which is why we have what we have now.
Which is, I guess, good for the clubs, but kind of depressing for the viewer, because it's kind of the same thing all the time. Like I said, there's 8 groups, and you know, because you have it divided up, so now it's like 4 teams coming from England, 4 from Spain, that kind of thing. That, you know, basically when you and I look at the groups, we can pretty much tell from more or less who's going to go through, because it's going to be your big clubs from England and not, you know, the champion of Romania or Cyprus or something like that.
For me, this is the problem with the whole group stage thing, which is that because it's played over 6 matches, it's easier for the better teams, the teams from England, Italy, Spain, to rise to the top after 6 games. Whereas when it was just a knockout, the team from, say, Romania could knock out the team from England over 2 legs, because it's in a shorter space of time, it's more likely there's an upset.
Right, and we don't mean to really come off like we don't like it, but I think it's just more so, it's kind of discouraging, because it's supposed to be this amazing tournament, and yet you have games where, like, a couple years ago, Liverpool, who didn't even finish champions of England, you know, beat the Turkish champion Beşiktaş, like, 7-1, 8-1, something like that, and it wasn't really that big of a deal. Whereas, like, you know, if Liverpool beat an English team, that by that degree, it'd be a huge deal. And so it's kind of like you see that as just this big disparity of wealth when it comes to the Champions League, and it makes it not very interesting football sometimes.
So you're saying there's too many mismatches, basically?
Oh, yeah, most definitely.
Yeah, I'd agree definitely in the group stage that happens a lot. And then the problem also is that when the big teams do play each other, like this Wednesday, there was Inter versus Barcelona, which was huge on paper. But what, it was 0-0?
Yeah, I mean, all in all, it was definitely a pretty bland game.
I think that's because it was a group stage game.
Yeah.
Okay, maybe towards the end of the group stage where teams are qualifying or not, maybe it's more interesting. But in the early stages of the group stage, where it's the two teams who expect to go through anyway, who cares, really?
Yeah.
And I think that's a real danger for the Champions League, is that it's sort of so many of the early games don't really count for anything. Even if a smaller team does pull off a result against a big team, they're still going to lose more games over the long run and not qualify for the next round. Didn't the Romanian team Cluj beat Roma last year, which is a huge result for them, but they still didn't qualify, so...
Yeah, so it doesn't... Yeah, like we said, it doesn't really matter sometimes. So would you find it more interesting if we kept the current system and then just had the knockout round, or would you find it more interesting if we just had knockout round all the way through, where Manchester United could get, you know, Real Madrid in their first game, or they could get CFR Cluj, you know, a really small team?
I think I'd favour a knockout round all the way through, but maybe with seeded teams, so that Manchester United and Real Madrid don't meet until later in the tournament.
Yeah, I think I definitely agree with that.
But a good reason that's never going to happen.
Would that be money as well?
That'd be money as well, yeah, because if Man United or Real Madrid did go out early...
Right, you lose that whole market there, yeah.
TV money gets lost. So at least with a group stage, you're guaranteed to see them play 6 times.
Right, but, you know, until then, we're still stuck with the group stage and then going to the knockout stage, where it tends to get pretty interesting.
Yeah, so that Inter-Barca match today, which not only finished goalless and was kind of dull, also was pretty meaningless. If that happened in the knockout stages, where one of those teams is going out, that'd be far more exciting. So I guess when we get to that stage, I want to ask you, who do you think is going to go through the group stage, through the knockout round, through the quarters, through the semis, to the final? Who's going to lift the trophy, Taylor?
All right, well, I would love to say my beloved Manchester United, but I don't know if this is a reverse jinx or it's just me being practical, but, you know, I've watched a couple games now, and I think the only team that I really could see doing it is Real Madrid. And it really hurts me because they spent so much money, and I hate them to begin with. But even with a pretty weak defense, they can still score, you know, goals whenever they feel like it. So until someone can stop them, I'm going to go with Madrid.
So do we want to maybe challenge each other here?
Oh, why? Who's your prediction?
Well, I wouldn't disagree with Madrid, but I feel maybe we'll pick different teams and then we'll stick with it through the tournament. Right. Maybe we'll just see who goes furthest, who comes closest.
Fair enough.
All right. Maybe we'll work out a little bet.
See, the sad thing here is that Madrid, either they'll win it or they're going to go out in the quarterfinals, and that's pretty much their pattern. So it could be over pretty quickly, this competition between you and I.
So I'm going to think outside the box a little bit as well. By not picking an English team or Barcelona.
That's outside the box.
I'm going to go Inter.
Okay.
I feel like Mourinho was signed on at Inter with the express target of winning the Champions League. I feel like maybe this year's the year they do it. So, yeah, in fact, I'm going to state yes, this is the year that Inter are going to do it. And we're going to see who goes furthest, Inter or Real Madrid.
One interesting point going off of that is that if you watch the game today, it's usually, you know, 11 on 11, but you would have been forgiven for having been mistaken in thinking that it was actually 12 on 11 because Mourinho spent about 99% of the game right on that touchline screaming instructions and pretty much being involved in the play. So you can get the impression that it's pretty important to him as well.
He's like a manager slash winger, hugging the touchline but just outside the field.
Yeah, he's doing a pretty good job of it as well. So I think he's doing all right. But the other interesting thing to remember here is that if you do plan on following Mourinho throughout the tournament, then you got to remember that the Champions League is no longer being shown on ESPN because they lost the rights to Fox Soccer Channel.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. This is the first year in the United States that ESPN didn't win the contract to show the Champions League. Fox Soccer Channel did instead. And we've talked about this sort of before.
Yeah, I believe last time we spoke about it, you were kind of happy about the fact that ESPN had lost it because it didn't seem like they were taking it particularly seriously. I was kind of in between, and I think I've since gone more the way of preferring ESPN to have it, mostly because it's just more readily available. You might say that's a bad thing, but, you know, it makes it easier for me to watch. I'm happy with it.
But for me, as someone who's got Fox Soccer Channel, it's kind of selfish, but I sort of prefer their approach to it so far. I remember the thing that used to annoy me on ESPN was they just blindly showed an English team every week. They didn't care.
Yeah.
So it was bizarre. It was like English teams were the only team that existed. And for me, part of the fun of the Champions League is that there's 32 teams from all across Europe. And so Fox Soccer Channel, the first game they showed on Tuesday just gone was Marseille versus AC Milan.
Which you wouldn't have seen before.
Exactly. It would have been the Manchester United game, I'd imagine, if it had been ESPN.
Yeah, which, you know, I'm a little biased on that one, but I definitely see where you're coming from because I agree. I think that's part of the romance of the tournament is that you can see a Romanian team play a Turkish team or play a Russian team. You know, you're not going to get that exposure. You're not going to get that access to it. So I definitely agree with you there. But I will say that, you know, before the final was, you know, on ESPN, it was really easy to watch, easy to be found. Now I believe that the Champions League final will be on FX, so I guess it's going to be before Rescue Me and after the Shield reruns. Is that how it works? And, you know, I just don't think...
Well, I haven't seen the schedule yet. Possibly.
It's a distinct possibility, and I think that, you know, that might not be giving the sport its due to have it, you know, on a fairly... I mean, I love Always Sunny, but maybe that's not the same thing as, you know, the biggest European tournament.
Yeah, it just seems strange to me that it's not on Fox Soccer Channel for the final. I mean, I understand that FX possibly has a wider exposure, but then it's the same problem of you exposing it to people who probably don't care.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, if someone is, maybe they're looking for a Shield rerun and they find that, they're not going to be happy. Well, the other big thing with the final this year is I believe it's the first time it's going to be on a weekend.
That's true, yes.
So normally it's Wednesday evening in Europe, which is Wednesday afternoon here in the United States.
Right. And now I think it's Saturday early afternoon, which is Eastern Standard Time, Saturday evening.
So it'd be Saturday evening in Europe and Saturday afternoon here, which I think that works out great for everybody, especially people on the East Coast of the United States.
Yeah. Unless you want to watch the Shield reruns at Saturday afternoon, then it could be a problem. But otherwise, you're totally good to go.
You're listening to the Total Football Soccer Show with Daryl
and Taylor on Richmond Independent Radio 97.3, radio for the rest of us.
This past weekend, Manchester City played Arsenal. A former Arsenal player, Emmanuel Adebayor, now with Manchester City, scored against his former club.
Right.
and caused a lot of trouble with his celebration.
Yeah, basically, Adebayor's transfer was one of the kind of prolonged deals of the summer. It was kind of willy-wony. And by the time he left to go to Manchester City, there was some pretty ill will between the two sides. So flash forward to this weekend, Adebayor, who's already at this point in the game, whether he not meant to, stamped on Robin van Persie, his ex-teammate's face.
Yep.
So then he scores a goal for Manchester City at one end of the field, sprints pretty much 100 yards and slides to celebrate in front of the Arsenal supporters, creating pretty much a riot. I believe a steward in the section was injured and there were, you know, items thrown on the field. Perhaps not the best way to celebrate the goal.
No, I mean, people were arrested as a result of the mm-hmm. trouble that was caused. I guess the question for me and you is it all Adebayor's fault?
Well, I think that there are two schools of thought on this one, and I'm going to come somewhere in between. Some say Adebayor is a trained professional, that he should know better, that he shouldn't be out to instigate these fans. You know, he's getting a paid salary by Manchester City. He should be happy, and he should celebrate with his fans.
Yeah.
There's the other, you know, side that says that these Arsenal fans spent these last months, you know, mocking him, you know, saying very inflammatory things about him. They ridiculed him throughout the game. They booed him throughout the game. So, of course, if that was you, you scored the goal, you're going to kind of want to stick it to him. So, you know, I think it's somewhere in between. What I think is definitely not excusable is what he did to Robin van Persie, which, if you watch the replay, looked like he tried to stomp on his face.
Yeah, it wasn't good.
And I'd say that the other thing that is inexcusable is I don't care if a player celebrates in front of you. You don't need to throw stuff on the pitch. You don't need to attack people who have nothing to do with the situation. I'd say that was kind of out of line as well.
I agree with that. What I think reflects very badly on Adebayor uh-huh. is it's not like he just did it in the heat of the moment.
Right.
If he'd scored the goal at the end where the Arsenal fans were, celebrated in front of them, that's just sticking it to them a little bit. Mm-hmm. But the fact that he ran the length of the pitch,
and,
which is a long way,
and dodged his own teammates to get past them to get to the other end.
Yeah, so he was clearly thinking and planning, mm-hmm. I'm going to do this, I'm going to annoy these Arsenal fans, and I just think that reflects very badly on him.
Well, I guess we can then agree that it wasn't the best celebration, nor was it the most intelligent, but it was certainly pretty memorable, which I guess is a pretty good segue into this week's top five most memorable goal celebrations. And okay. I'm hoping Adebayor didn't make your list.
No, I think we didn't talk about this before, but I'm assuming neither of us put it on the list.
Yeah, he's not on mine, but I'll let you take the lead.
I've gone a little bit different with my top five this week in that some of these are sort of representative of themes rather than individual goal celebrations.
All right.
So my number five is Robbie Keane.
Ah, okay.
All right. Former Wolves player, so I'm a big fan of his. But the goal celebration that he used to do, he stopped it now, was just awful. He used to sort of run, do a little forward roll, and then pretend to fire an arrow into the crowd, which maybe sounds cool, but when you see it, it looks like, I don't know, kindergarten gymnastics. So he's representative of rubbish celebrations.
My celebrations are a little more... how do I say? Outspoken.
Okay.
So number five is Craig Bellamy. The Welsh international was playing for Liverpool, and allegedly he got into a fight, a drunken fight, I believe, with his then teammate Gianluca Risse over karaoke.
And as you do.
As you often do. And for whatever reason, he decided the best way to settle the dispute was to attack Risse, allegedly, with a golf club.
Okay, a lot of allegedlies when you talk about Craig Bellamy.
Yeah, a lot.
Allegedly.
So... fast forward to their match against Barcelona in the Champions League. Bellamy scores a goal, runs to the touchline, and just does a gigantic golf swing.
Wonderful.
And I think no better way to celebrate a goal than to reenact a savage beating of your alleged teammate.
My number four also involves injuries, but they're self-inflicted injuries. This is players who injure themselves while celebrating. So the guy I've chosen to represent this is Lamana Lualua.
Mm-hmm.
He's Congolese, but he played for Newcastle for a couple of seasons. And he was famous for his backflip celebrations. He'd do like multiple backflip, somersault kind of things.
Yeah.
But in 2006, playing for Portsmouth, actually, after he'd left Newcastle, he scored against Arsenal and did a couple of flips and injured his ankle in the process. Another guy who I didn't keep him on the list, but he's like very representative of this, is a guy I've never heard of until I read this story. His name's Paolo Diogo, or maybe Diogo. He was a Swiss player playing for Servette. And in 2004, he scored and tried to jump over the fence into the crowd to celebrate. Got his wedding band caught on the fence and ripped off the top of his wedding finger. Surgeons found the finger but couldn't reattach it, so he's got a permanent reminder of that goal.
Yeah, not the way he probably hoped for. My number four is a little more recent. It's Ruud van Nistelrooy. The Dutchman was playing for his national team at a World Cup qualifier against Andorra, and he goes to take a penalty kick, and he misses it and it hits off the post. And an Andorran defender runs up and laughs in his face. Like, it's right in his face and laughs at him.
I can imagine Rude didn't like that.
Not so much. And so later on, it was like the 86th minute, and he scores a goal. And you see him jog to celebrate. Then kind of like a light bulb goes off, and he turns around, sprints back, just, you know, sprints back to jump right in the guy's face, and then just sticks both arms up in the air in front of him, doesn't say anything, and just kind of stands there shaking his hands, celebrating before he's pretty much mobbed by the other team and his own team. But still, I think, you know, not particularly classy, but very, very funny.
So my number three is the opposite of my number five. It's individual goal celebrations that sort of live long in the memory.
Right.
So I've got very fond memories of the 1990 World Cup, Italia 90. Might have been a little before your time, I'm not sure.
Yeah, I was alive. I was
one of the big stories at Italia 90 was Roger Miller, who was a then 38-year-old Cameroonian striker.
I love this one.
I think he scored maybe four goals in the tournament.
Yeah.
But he celebrated each goal by sort of running into the corner flag, one hand on his hip, one in the air, and sort of doing a nice little hip-wiggling dance.
If you were in middle school, the principal would have separated him from the corner flag.
Yeah,
it was a bit graphic.
But that sort of went down in history, and I think a lot of people sort of copied that celebration as well. Just for my fond memories, that's my number three.
Nice. Well, I have semi-fond memories of my number three. That's Diego Forlan. Before he was a great goal scorer for Atletico Madrid, he was a fairly middling striker for Manchester United.
He was a non-goal scorer.
There you go. But he had one good one where he had a crack and it went upper 90, and he was so excited to celebrate that he rips off his jersey and goes running. But he kind of forgets that he's wearing Under Armour underneath the jersey, so it's clinging to his uniform. So they go to restart the game after the goal, and he still can't get the jersey back on because the Under Armour won't fit on.
Okay.
So now he spends the next 30 seconds running around the field, jersey and Under Armour in one hand, just shirtless, trying to tackle a defender or do something to stop the play. So finally the referee takes pity on him and halts play so he can put his jersey on. But it's really just a perfect metaphor of how inept Diego Forlan was at Manchester United that he couldn't even put his jersey back on.
Yeah, definitely. So that made me laugh. So my number two is all about celebrations with a sense of humour.
Uh-huh.
And the man I've chosen to represent this is German striker Jürgen Klinsmann.
Mm-hmm.
He joined Tottenham Hotspur, the English team, in 1994. And Klinsmann had a reputation for diving. So
right.
There's a lot of talk in the media and with fans about how much he dived. He was a diver, all this. So the first time Klinsmann scored, he sort of ran across the field and did a massive sort of Superman dive with his arms out, landed on his chest. And then all his teammates who were in on it also came and piled in behind him diving. It's a great, great moment.
Yeah.
And it also sort of really turned public opinion because it was sort of suggested he could laugh at himself and didn't take himself too seriously. And there weren't really many more accusations of diving after that.
Well, I'm going to go the complete opposite of that because my number two certainly took himself pretty seriously. That's Eric Cantona. The Manchester United striker was playing a game against Sunderland. And if you watch the YouTube video, I would say it's one of the best goals I've ever seen. He pretty much beats
it.
Yes.
Oh,
he beats pretty much their entire team. He has a defender on his left side, a defender on his right side. And he just has a dead stop, and he chips the keeper from about 20 yards out. It goes right over his head, hits off the post, goes in the goal. Cantona barely saw it go in the goal because he was already celebrating. And his celebration was to simply stand in place, lift his arms in air, and slowly rotate in circles. Which is
with his pop collar, right?
Oh yeah, with his pop collar, of course. He was the architect of that one. But I gotta say, that may be one of the most arrogant celebrations ever, as if to say, it was all me.
Yeah.
I did everything.
I say if he earns it, it's okay to do it.
Yeah, yeah.
So we're at number one already.
We are indeed.
Okay, so my number one, maybe not controversial, but it's a little different, is the non-celebration.
Uh-huh.
I'm thinking specifically of Dennis Law.
Oh, yeah.
Who
I have very mixed emotions about this celebration.
Okay, so Dennis Law is a Manchester United legend, but he spent his final season with Manchester City. At the end of the 73-74 season, Man City played Man United in a game that Man United needed to win to avoid relegation. Yeah. Dennis Law scores an absolutely fantastic goal, you got to agree, for Man City.
Yeah.
A back heel.
Mm-hmm.
That ultimately gave them the 1-0 win. But Dennis Law scored it and just turned around, kept his arms at his side and very solemnly walked away. No celebration. So I think it's really classy when players don't celebrate scoring against their former team, especially when they've got a really emotional connection with them. I think that's maybe something Emmanuel Adebayor should be aware of.
Yeah, most definitely. You went the humble route. I'll say that Adebayor could have had a far worse celebration, which would be my number one, and that's Robbie Fowler.
Oh.
Yeah. In a 1999 match, his Liverpool were playing Everton, who are their cross-city rivals. And Fowler's brother had had a drug arrest, and Fowler was kind of linked with some drug use. They were making fun of him throughout the game for being a drug addict. So he scores a penalty, runs to the touchline, which is white, bends down, and proceeds to pretend to snort the touchline, yeah. Which was not well received by the FA. He was fined for that one. But my personal favorite story about this incident was that his then-coach, Gerard Houllier, couldn't figure out what the big deal was, and when asked why he wasn't in favor of the suspension, responded, "I don't understand what the big deal was. He was just pretending to eat the grass." A man that blind, not surprisingly, not the best manager in football.
Oh.
Those were our top five all-time goal celebrations. If you got a list of your own favorite goal celebrations, then feel free to send them to us at soccer@wrar.org.
You're listening to the Total Football Soccer Show with Daryl
and Taylor on Richmond Independent Radio 97.3, radio for the rest of us.
So we didn't get any emails about our top five last week, but we did get a few emails about our spelling bee.
H is not a letter, Daryl. H is not a letter.
That's what some of the emails said. They weren't so concerned about the difference between American and British pronunciation of the letter H or H.
There it is, H. Whichever. That's the one I know.
It was more that basically when I pronounced the name of the Spanish player, Moises Hurtado, I should have pronounced it like that and not pronounced the letter H at the front of his name. So I said Hurtado, which threw Taylor off, and as a result, he got that name wrong in the spelling bee.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, I have an audio recording of Taylor saying he doesn't think that's correct, but he's going to let it stand.
Yeah.
So we can't change. Yeah. We can't change the result.
Verbal proof is not fun to refute, but such is life.
I would say in my defense that people in England tend not to speak as much Spanish as people in America.
That's true.
I've got that in my defense. Okay, so in recognition of what we'll refer to as the event from last week.
Yeah.
This week, the spelling bee is themed around the letter H.
H from now on. Okay, so Daryl, this week I would like for you to spell Korean forward Seol Ki-hyun.
Say that again?
Seol Ki-hyun. That's the best as I can do.
Well, I'm going to be checking your pronunciation.
And more than you deserve.
Okay. I don't know, but I'm going to try. Seoul, I'm going to spell like the city. S-E-O-U-L. And can you say the
Ki-hyun? I won't even make you add the hyphen.
Okay. I'll do it fast in case it's embarrassing.
Okay.
H-I-Y-E-U-N-G. Laughing isn't good, is it?
I'm still laughing at H. It's S-E-O-L. K-I-hyphen-H-Y-E-O-N.
Oh, I do have a complaint this week.
Oh, what's that?
Which is that Korean players' names are not written in the same alphabet as ours. Uh-huh. So the spelling is kind of debatable.
Oh. Well,
yeah.
According to my paper, there's an H in there. So.
Well, I can write anything on a piece of paper and say that's the spelling.
Oh, for one for this week, Daryl.
I could have spelled it in Korean for the record, though.
Okay. Could you have spelled it in Korean?
Well, it's too late now because it's...
Okay,
it's
fair enough, fair enough. Yeah. You're right.
But for the record, I could have.
Fair enough, for the record. We're all about the record this week.
Yeah. All right, so I guess we'll do mine.
Uh-huh.
Okay, I've chosen a name that uses the same alphabet that you're familiar with.
Uh-huh.
I'd like you to spell former Chelsea striker Jimmy Floyd Hasselbank.
Oh, there's so many double letters in here. And I'm going to get it wrong to start. J-I-M-M-Y? Am I already wrong to begin with?
No, it's fine.
Okay. F-L-O-Y-D-H-A-S-S-E-L-B-A-N-C-K?
Oh, no. But yeah, I'll give you credit. You were right all the way until the end.
Was it just K, not C-K?
No, the last bit is spelled B-A-I-N-K. It's that I that probably shouldn't be there, but it is. So both wrong this week, so that leaves us what?
Continuing the tradition of neither one of us getting right is where it leaves us.
Two all?
I think next week we're going to do like three-letter players or something like that. We've got to get the spelling bee on track. All right, so that leaves us at 2-2 through 7 weeks. We're a combined 2-14.
Actually, we've only done 5 spelling bees, so we are
2-10.
2-10.
Okay, I feel better about
that. That's much better.
20%, I can handle 20%. 20% is fine.
Well, imagine if that was your test result on a school paper, school spelling test.
Like I said, I can handle 20%. That's fine with me.
Okay, so that's the end of the show. And to close things out, in honor of our woeful spelling bee performance, Taylor's going to read us a quote from Mark Twain.
"I don't give a damn for a man that can only spell a word one way."